Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Gishpulova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with Tatiana Zhurzhenko, one of the editors of War and Memory in Russia, Ukraine and Belarus, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. Tatiana Zhurzhenko has a PhD in social philosophy. In 2002, Tatiana Zhurzhenko moved to Vienna as Lisa Meitner Fellow at the Institute for East European History, University of Vienna, where she conducted research on the identities and discourses in the Ukrainian-Russian borderlands. Tatiana Zhurzhenko teaches on the Eastern European politics at the University of Vienna. She's also the author of Borderlands into Bordered Lands, Geopolitics of Identity in Post-Soviet Ukraine, published in 2010. This book was awarded with the Best Book Prize 2010 of the American Association for Ukrainian Studies and with the Bronze Award of the Association for Borderland Studies in 2012. Hello, Tatiana.
Hello, Natalia.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really intrigued by this publication, which appeared a few years ago, and I'm very happy that we will have this chance to discuss it today. So the title, War and Memory in Russia, Ukraine and Belarus, may sound ambiguous and unclear, especially for those outside of the former Soviet Union. It's not quite clear what war is referred to. But on the other hand, everybody who has some sort of memory of the Soviet Union will know almost immediately that the Second World War is meant here. The name of the book also appears symbolic, the ongoing military conflict between Russia and Ukraine, and now the conflict in Belarus, which was not happening when the volume appeared. Would you guide us through the idea of the volume and through the decision to focus on the three countries?
Thank you, Natalia, and thank you for your invitation. I'm very happy to talk with you about this book, which I co-edited together with my colleagues from the Alexander Institute in Helsinki, Marko Kangaspura and Jussi Lassila, and also with another colleague. She is now working at the University of Melbourne in Australia, Julie Feder, and I will later explain how we all somehow came together to work on this book. But I wanted to start with the title. Indeed, the title might seem a bit laconic, maybe, and not informative enough. But nowadays, the editors are not the only ones responsible for the title. You know, the publisher has a say also concerning the title. So in the end, it was a compromise because the publisher wanted it short and to have like keywords in the title. So we ended up with memory and war and memory. And the three countries we are focusing on. But initially, the title was supposed to be something like re-narrating heroism, making sense of suffering, memories of World War II in Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus. So it was more, in a way, more informative. And the idea of the book emerged from a small conference we held at the Alexander Institute in Helsinki, because Alexander Institute was a partner in the project called Memory at War, Cultural Dynamics in Poland, Russia, and Ukraine. And this project was hosted by Cambridge and led by Alexander Edkind. And actually, my colleagues who are involved in memory studies in our region, they, of course, know about this project because it was one of the kind of milestones in the development of the field. And I was lucky to be involved in one of the branches of this project, which was settled in Helsinki. And our part of the project focused on media narratives and actually on Russia more than on other countries, which is understandable for the Alexander Institute because Russia is their primary focus. So for me, it was also an interesting experience to switch from Ukraine to Russia and to be able to compare these two countries and the dynamics of memory politics, especially on the local level. So this is how the idea of the book emerged. We, I think it was in autumn 2012, we had this under the title Narratives of Suffering, I guess, and several very interesting papers. And as always, then we discussed how to make it into a special issue or a book. We had papers on Russia, we had papers on Ukraine, we actually also had papers on some other post-Soviet countries, I think it was Estonia. But when we started to think about how to make it a book, we realized that we need a focus, we need something which would make this book special, and we decided actually to focus on Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus as three post-Soviet states, which used to be the core of the East Slavic core of the Soviet Union, and having shared in the past like the Soviet commemorative culture, the Soviet kind of framework of remembering about the Great Patriotic War. And our idea was to try to trace these diverging paths of these three countries in terms of their attitudes to the memory of Second World War and to the interpretation of this event, but also transformation of these commemorative cultures. So that's why we decided to focus on these three countries and to make our volume more coherent and also different from other collective volumes. And this was basically the last year before the Euromaidan. This was the last year before the annexation of Crimea when we started to work on this, and we invited other people to contribute, renowned scholars as well as younger authors who just finished their dissertations. And then the year 2014 was a kind of shock for all of us, and it also affected our work because it totally changed the context of the debate. Right, the memory of the Second World War became not only politicized, but what we call it in the introduction, weaponized. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was really used to mobilize for example, in Ukraine, to mobilize the the pro-Russian sentiment, and it was used to undermine the legitimacy of the Ukrainian state, and it was it has become not just contested, but really performed on the streets as somehow the opposing sides used it as to frame the ongoing conflict in terms of fascism, anti-fascism, notions like that. Yeah, so it has become difficult to continue with our project and the annexation of Crimea, and then later the decommunization laws in Ukraine, as I said, have changed the context so that some chapters needed to be updated, and we needed to think how we put this all together in this new post 2014 context. But still, I think three underlying ideas we had in mind from the very beginning, they were still central for us. And this is to look not only on the official discourses and official memory politics, but also on grassroots initiatives and new communities of memory, not only political actors, but also societal actors involved in memory politics, such as, for example, we have chapters on former Ostarbeiter in Ukraine. We have chapters on Afghanistan war veterans in Belarus. We have a chapter on children of war in Russia. So new communities of memory which emerged recently, right? So this was one intention to look at also at local commemorative cultures to approach various dimensions of our topic. And the second one was to reflect on this generational shift, which is currently happening in the field of collective memory in the post-Soviet states, the transition from communicative to cultural memory as far as the Second World War is concerned. So this notions of communicative memory and cultural memory goes back to Jan and Elida Assmann, famous German cultural scientists and historians. And it's a kind of obvious thought, I think, that the last witnesses, people who experienced the Second World War directly as soldiers, as children, as witnesses, as people who still remember these events from their personal experience, they are getting older and they are slowly leaving, right? And this, of course, affects very much the way how post-Soviet societies, and not only post-Soviet societies, I think it concerns also, of course, other countries, how they conceptualize the World War II and how the memory of this event is recodified and re-narrated, becoming part of the cultural canon and not just kind of biographic experience. So we tried to keep this in mind when we worked on this book. And of course, probably the third organizing idea, the third intention behind this project was to trace these divergent trajectories of the three post-Soviet countries, very different post-Soviet countries, Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus, and to try to reflect on how the common Soviet commemorative culture is being transformed, adjusted to the new political agenda in each particular case.
Could we spend some time identifying the specificities of memory politics regarding the Second World War in these three countries? What are the main instances that make the memory of the Second World War in the three countries similar and different, as you mentioned a little bit, like in your final statement when responding to the first question?
So this is, of course, a big question, and I will be, I don't know if my answer is going to be complete, but I would probably start with the, saying that actually, even in the Soviet era, despite the official Soviet canon, which was imposed on the Soviet society from above, there were significant differences how collective memory functioned in Ukraine, in Russia, and in Belarus. And we know that this in Belarus, for example, the myth of a partisan republic was shaped during the Soviet decades. Yeah, the idea that this partisan resistance, partisan movement, was so widespread in Belarus, so that they could claim this as part as their collective identity, right? And Vladislav Hrynevich wrote long time ago about on how actually the collective memory of Second World War in Ukraine was rather different from Russia due to many facts, due to, of course, to the different experience that the population of Western Ukraine had with the Second World War, due to the fact that the whole Ukrainian territory was actually occupied and experienced enormous hardships and destruction and losses of population and destruction of the infrastructure, and due to the fact that basically the population, the Ukrainian population, to some extent lived for years or even longer after under the Nazi occupation, yeah. So this experience of being on the occupied territory, and so many other moments here, I think, are important. But of course, in the post-Soviet era, these differences became even more obvious. And this has to do, of course, with the trajectories of nation building, different trajectories. For example, Russia took this role represented itself as a successor of the USSR, and of course as a successor of this legacy of great victory, which in the Ukrainian case was one of the narratives in Ukraine, but it was contested by other rather politically powerful narratives, right? There have been differences in the political regimes which emerged in post-Soviet Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus. In Ukraine, we have much higher level of political competitiveness and so incentives actually for various political actors to instrumentalize competing narratives of World War II, which became especially visible from the end of the 90s, probably, and with the Orange Revolution, but also during the Yanukovych presidency. So this kind of instrumentalization of historical narratives, instrumentalization of the memory of the Second World War, became one of the political technologies used by different political forces, and unfortunately, it had this polarizing effect of these political technologies was destructive for Ukraine, and we came to realize it rather late that these political strategies were so had negative consequences. And in Belarus, Belarus also positioned itself as a successor of the Belarusian Soviet Socialist Republic, especially with Lukashenko having become president of Belarus, So the political regime in Belarus have been using the memory of the Great Patriotic War to consolidate the Belarusian society, but also to provide an ideological background for the post-Soviet Belarusian state. But we can also see today in Belarus that actually both the opposition, the protesters, and the regime are referring to the concepts and notions of this historical narrative. Yeah, referring to the partisan tradition, referring to the fighting fascists and resistance, and we saw the same actually in Ukraine when both sides in 2014 referred to the Great Patriotic War, not only the anti-Maidan protesters and the pro-Russian protesters appropriated this narrative, fighting on the right side, but also the pro-Ukrainian side referred to the victory in the Great Patriotic War to claim this tradition and build a new narrative, actually drawing these parallels and saying we were victorious in 1945 and we are going to win again in this war with Russia. So this was the slogan which, for example, the Ukrainian Institute of National Remembrance used in the first post-Maidan years to frame the commemorations of the 9th of May in Ukraine. So both sides actually referred to this symbolic resources of this Soviet commemorative culture.
How would you describe the current memory politics in Ukraine? Or what is prioritized? Is there any consistency? Is consistency an answer in general to the issues of memory politics?
Yeah, so again, it's a question where I don't even know where to start because after the Euromaidan and with the in this new like post-Maidan Ukraine, one could talk about certain political line. Yeah, there was the Institute for National Remembrance was very active in shaping this kind of new vision. And then there was this decommunization laws, which introduced kind of new paradigm, right? And it was met with some criticism from certain parts of the Ukrainian society and politicum, but still one could see about certain agenda and certain tendency, right? What we can observe now, I think there is no such kind of unified vision or no such agenda that the new leadership, political leadership of Ukraine would have. Yeah, and the Institute of National Remembrance, in my eyes, I'm not monitoring this for a dialogue rather than a kind of executive body, which this institute used to be under Poroshenko. Yeah, and it's not, I think, that they are imposing anything in as the only vision, yeah, as the only official narrative. So for me, what we have been experiencing during the last year or year and a half is more like depolitization and desecuritization of the discourse of memory, which is probably not so bad because it gives some space, I think, for dialogue and for deliberation, yeah, something which was rather difficult in the years before. Again, some segments of the Ukrainian society, especially among the activists, the people who have been very much involved in democratic reforms in Ukraine, in transformation processes, this can be perceived as a kind of vacuum, maybe, that the authorities don't know what they want. But on the other hand, I think it gives like some space to breathe and to discuss, and it gives some space for local initiatives, for kind of decentralized politics of memory, which is probably something which is a good thing for the Ukrainian society right now. So this is where I would probably stop.
Mm-hmm. So keeping in mind memory politics, how can the Donbas and Crimea be positioned in the collective memorial space? And maybe what memory politics should be implemented in order to reintegrate these two occupied geographical bodies in the Ukrainian territory?
I think the Donbas and Crimea are two different regions in this sense, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think Crimea can be reintegrated by means of memory politics. It's a territory which is now part of the other state, right, with all political institutions, state institutions of the Russian Federation now working to integrate Crimea in Russia, right? And it's very little that Ukraine do in this respect, somehow to offer kind of alternative without being able to be present, there. So I think what concerns Crimea, I think it's very important that Crimea remains in our horizon of thinking and attention and discussions, that it's not forgotten, and it's we still consider it a part of our imaginary space, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but in terms of politics, I don't know what we can do to reintegrate Crimea without without challenging the military power of Russia, right? So Donbass is different because Donbass is still somehow is perceived as a territory which one day can return to Ukraine. Yeah, and Donbass is divided by the current conflict. So when we talk about Donbass, we mean actually both parts. Yeah, the part which is under control of Ukraine and the part which is not controlled by the Kyiv government. So Ukraine can do a lot on the territory which is under the Ukrainian control, and I don't know if what has been done before is sufficient, because it's a very important issue how memory politics, which was implemented in Ukraine after the Euromaidan, and especially the decommunization law, the legislation, this kind of symbolic cleansing of the post-Soviet landscape, removing communist monuments, renaming streets. It was, of course, not welcomed by everybody in eastern Ukraine, and Donbass is a very special region in this respect. We know it, the local identity is very much draws on this Soviet legacy and the myth of the Donbass as a cradle of the proletarian culture and economic achievements of Soviet Ukraine, right? So it has been rather controversial, and in terms of reintegrating Ukraine. Yeah. On the other hand, I think it's very important that this Ukraine-controlled part of Donbass experienced all these changes with the rest of Ukraine. Yeah. And went through this sometimes painful, but I think still important transformations. And still, I think what is really needed is more like politics focusing on local initiatives, on grassroots initiatives, on kind of decentralized memory politics involving I think local communities into this kind of everyday work and reimagining this territory and reinventing, renovating the territory, the identity of this territory, right? And I think there is still a lot to do in this respect.
So you teach in the Eastern European politics at the University of Vienna, and would you share your experience with us? Would you share with us what your students are interested in terms of Eastern European politics?
So I have been teaching different courses. For example, I'm teaching now a lecture course on nationalism after communism, which covers Eastern Europe and the post-Soviet space, and addresses actually all this complexity of issues from nation building to ethnic conflicts and the rise of new nationalism, for example, in East Central Europe. But I have been also teaching for many years courses on memory politics and memory wars and in Eastern Europe, right? But last semester, I have been teaching a course on memory wars, reconciliation, and apology and reconciliation in international relations. So I was focusing on approaches in political science, which are used in international politics and international relations. So, for example, why some states apologize for the former atrocities and wrongdoings and others are not? Why some countries manage to reconcile and others fail? And why in some cases, for example, the most recent case is that this memory war between Russia and Poland, which we could observe last year, why some countries are indulging in such mnemonic battles to the extent that their presidents start kind of writing historical articles and defending what they think is historical truths. Yeah. So these are interesting topics, and I from my experience, students are very interested in these topics. Not only Austrian students, we have a lot of Erasmus students at the University of Vienna. We have students from Eastern Europe. We have also from Western Europe, from Scandinavia. So, and I mostly teach in English. That's why we have. I also have like a lot of international students, and it's always exciting to discuss such topics in a multicultural environment, in a multinational environment, because they can bring the mm-hmm. examples, and we can see basically that what we think is going to be like Eastern European phenomenon, this memory wars, are not at all limited to Eastern Europe. Yeah, we could see this eruption of mnemonic conflicts all over the world. Like in the United States, it was Black Lives Matters movement, which actually questioned the legitimacy of the of some historical monuments and even dismantled some of them. And this is a movement which had echo in also in Europe. We know that some statues of historical figures were desecrated or torn down in the UK, but also here in Vienna we had right now kind of controversy, which is an old controversy, but it was somehow through these events, global kind of events, came to the fore again. This is a controversy around the former mayor of Vienna, Karl Lueger, who is considered the modernizer of Vienna. So the mayor of Vienna before the World War I. But because he is considered to be anti-Semitic in his statements and his... So he is now a questionable... again, contested personality, and his monument in Vienna was became a site of protests and art artistic interventions and open conflicts, and I was a witness of this escalation in the last weeks, and one of the assignments that my students, for example, had this semester was to compare contested monuments in various contexts, mm-hmm. starting from the Eastern European context to Austria, to the United States. And I think we will find more similarities than we think if we look at this phenomenon in a comparative way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I usually conclude our interviews with this question about my guests' recent research projects. Would you tell us just a few words about your recent project? Is it in any way connected with this volume that was published a few years ago?
I wrote several papers which somehow deal with various aspects of memory politics in Ukraine, but not only in Ukraine. So my kind of long term interest is this the memory controversies about memory politics between Ukraine and Russia, and I got interested in one particular historical figure, commemoration of this historical figure, who is the Prince Vladimir, yeah, who is considered both in Ukraine and in Russia as a kind of a founder of the nation. So he, in a way, he unites and divides Ukrainians mm-hmm. and Russians. And for me, it was interesting to see how actually we know that there is one monument to Vladimir in Kyiv, which is from the 19th century, from the imperial times. But in the post-Soviet era, one could have monuments to Vladimir or Volodymyr in Ukraine and in Russia. Yeah, many of them are local projects, others more like inspired from above. We remember this initiative, the project which was supported by President Putin some years ago. A huge statue of Vladimir was erected in Moscow, in the near Kremlin, in the central part of Moscow. So I became interested in this phenomenon, kind of proliferation of Vladimirs mm-hmm. or Vladimirs in both countries, mm-hmm. and also in the religious uses of these statues, because they are, interestingly enough, they are on a kind of boundary between sacral and... Yeah, so they are actually, what I wanted to say, they are part of the public space, but they are also kind of sacral objects, yeah, but they are still not, from the Orthodox tradition point of view, they are not the same as Orthodox icons, yeah, and it's a kind of borderland phenomenon, right? So they are in between. And to some extent, I think there's also kind of influence of Soviet monumental art in this tradition to erect statues of Orthodox saints, and which was not part of the original Orthodox tradition in our part of the world. So this was one of the small projects which I worked on in recently, and finished my paper, which I started writing when I was doing research in Russia, namely in Murmansk and Veliky Novgorod, and I was interested in local memorial cultures of World War II, but also in the role that the local media is playing in reproducing and reshaping these memorial cultures. And so this was a project based on interviews with local journalists in these two regions. And it's actually very refreshing to see that the local memory of the World War II in Russia is actually very different in different regions, and there is also a plurality of local actors and communities of memory involved in these initiatives and in local politics of memory, shaping it from below. Yeah. So this is another paper which I was working on recently.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Tatiana. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation today. And thank you for this volume that nuances and details the memory politics strategies developed and implemented in these three countries, Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus. And your volume offers this excellent opportunity to trace different trajectories that these three countries, which used to share some commemorative practices, now engage in with different practices, and they illustrate these different practices. Thank you so much, Tatiana.
Thank you, Natalia.
Today I spoke with Tatiana Zhurzhenko, one of the editors of War and Memory in Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. Thank you for listening to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.